Welcome back to the Mojo Podcast, a place for curious minds to fill up on leadership inspiration and hear wonderful stories of mojo, lost and found, high and low. I'm your host, Richard Stokes, and we meet here every fortnight to spend time with a diverse and brilliant group of guests who've been generous to spend time with me. This sixth series is all about commitment, a concept we all understand, but can prove somewhat elusive to us, even fearful for us. In this series, I wanted to get under the skin of commitment, how we can commit to ourselves, to our values, our purpose, and the payoff we can see when we literally choose not to have any more choice. Commitment is one of life's beautiful paradoxes. This week, I have a really powerful conversation for you. I've been hosting this podcast for nearly 5 years and over 80 episodes, and this is one of the most raw, emotional conversations to date.
When you're playing professional sport, it's alpha. It's no vulnerability. You can't show weakness. You can't show weakness to your teammates, let alone the opposition. You have to front up always. And, you know, I look back on my experience and as a man, what would I describe the most overarching feeling I had in the last 2 or 3 years of me kind of falling apart? Loneliness. I felt so lonely.
My wonderful guest is Luke Sutton, former professional cricketer and now sports agent, author and podcaster, amongst many other things. I'm extremely grateful to Luke for agreeing to join the podcast today and share the warts and all story of his battle with alcoholism whilst being a player, his journey to and through rehab, and how this experience 13 years ago has shaped the life he leads today and will forever, essentially how he rebuilt himself. This is a powerful conversation, so I want to jump straight into it. Suffice to say, I'll put a trigger warning here as we talk at length about addiction and its consequences. It's hard to hear in parts, but it's just so, so important. I hope you get so much from this conversation. We recorded at the Hub here in Ibiza, where Luke and I are both members. And please do remember the Holy Trinity for podcasters. Please do rate, review, and share this podcast so more people get the opportunity to hear it. This is a very special one. Over to my conversation with Luke Sutton. Welcome back to the Mojo Podcast, and we're back in the Hub, in the podcast studio at the Hub here in Ibiza, because I'm with a fellow Ibiza resident. I'm with Luke Sutton. Luke, how are you doing?
Great, thank you. Looking forward to this.
Yeah, me too. I've been meaning to get you on this podcast for some time, and when this season of commitment came around, I just knew this was the right time, and our diaries aligned, so it's great to be here. And I always start at this place. So when you think of your mojo and how you're doing today, where are you out of 10?
Honestly, it sounds a bit cliche, but I feel really high. Yeah, like I'd give it a 9.5. Really good.
Oh, magic. So what's going on for you with that high score? And in that, when I say mojo, that word, what was coming up for you and giving you that high score?
I just think it's, for me, it's not necessarily what's going on in today or yesterday or the week. It's more just how I am in myself about what's ahead today. And I know I came into the Hub today, I was just really looking forward to today. Obviously I was recording with you, but just other stuff. I think that's what mojo feels to me. It's just like being ready for whatever, you know, and embracing I don't know how today's going to go. There'll be some good, there'll be some not so good, but I'm ready for it. I'm good. And when I'm at my best, that's how I feel, and I feel good today.
Oh, fabulous. And that, I get this sense of just being okay with the unknown, with the unexpected, I'm getting the sense of being in the flow of life from you as well.
Yeah, definitely. And maybe embracing the adventure of it, you know, and not, I feel at my best when I don't necessarily have expectation. You know, I don't think anything's owed to me, or, you know, just like, well, let's see what happens today. It's great. You know, it's Friday. I'm really looking forward to it, going to the weekend. When I know I'm at my best, when I feel really open to whatever, and it will all be fine. I think that really sort of sums it up for me, what around that word mojo.
Lovely. And for listeners, and obviously I've introduced you in the intro, but what do people need to know about you, Luke the person, to get the most out of this podcast episode they're listening to today?
It's a really good question, actually, which I've slightly stressed on. I think the first thing I would say is I'm a father of twins, a boy and a girl, and I have two stepsons. I have an unbelievable wife in Jojo, who you know well. Yeah. But my story also is one of professional sport, professional cricket. I played for nearly 20 years, which is a pretty long time in the realm of professional sport. I also had a complete and utter breakdown towards the end of my cricket career, which involved me going to rehab and having serious issues with alcohol, and essentially my life completely and utterly falling apart, and then rebuilding. And rebuilding on a who I am, how I tackle life, what it means to me, and who did I want to be going forward, and I really did have to rebuild from bottom up, and that was nearly 13 years ago. So that's been a heck of a journey for me, and in those 13 years, I have become, I guess, without wanting to sound like an idiot, a businessman, and I've got successful at it. I met Jojo and have the most beautiful relationship. I have an unbelievable relationship with my ex-wife. I come to Ibiza, I'm back and forth to the UK as well. And I love life. And I'm sober nearly 13 years. And it's all part of my journey. It's all part of who I am, the rise and the fall and then the recovery. I think it's important to probably contextualize that for people, that my journey is not one of always success and quite or always failure. It's a bit of everything.
Yeah, and I think there, as I said at the top, there's many reasons why I was really keen to get you on, but talking about this area, this idea of commitment and the commitments that you've made at different points in your life, and I'd really like to just to get into that a little bit. And you've obviously, for context, you've talked about some of those areas already. If we sort of wind back a bit and look at life in cricket as a professional sportsman, what was commitment then? Because I have not played anything near professional sport, but I do have a sense of it being of a high commitment environment. What was it like for you?
Yeah, so I, the word I would use, which I think links with commitment actually, is survival. Professional sport is survival. Wow. And a lot of people think that when you've first sign your first professional contract, you've kind of made it, and then but then you might hear the odd cliche like, this is when the hard work starts and you're competing against the best and you need to keep going. The reality is, when you step into professional sport, you're also competing against your teammates, your squad. I don't know if brutal's the right word, but it's very intense. And so, do you want to be a professional sports person for a year, 2 years, 5 years, be lucky enough to do it for 20 years? You have to survive. And it therefore requires this commitment to what do I need to do to survive? And because if I don't commit to that, I'm done. And during my time, playing professional cricket in those 20 years, I must have seen thousands of guys come and go. And the difference between the guys who could stay for a long period of time and not was that, I don't know if I've got the right phrases for it. It's like deep dog in them, I am going to make this work. It was, and me included, almost never the most talented. It was the guys who were like, there's something very deep in them going, I'm going to make this work. I'm going to survive. And that was definitely my experience.
Wow. And I mean, thanks for creating that context of something that I don't think a lot of us as armchair sports fans will probably see or necessarily get a sense of. But I also, maybe to put it into the life of, a life I have led, and when you work in a business, there's a competitive environment. I have a lot of, actually these days, friends will say to me, it feels more competitive internally than it kind of does externally. I have to sort of, those elbows out fighting for my space. So what is it, and I don't know if this is a positive thing, but what allows you as a man to access that doggedness, that that fight for survival in that kind of competitive setup?
I don't know, 100%. I've looked at it sort of, and Jojo sometimes says it to me, you know, basically by nature I'm quite a gentle man, you know, but there is something within me which is like a rage almost, and I don't know where it came from, but I know that the word rage, it sort of sounds aggressive, doesn't it? And actually in the survival mechanism it is, but there's almost that kind of deep rage of like, I'm going to prove you wrong. I'm going to, the you being, I don't know who, but you know, it could be a number of people, even including myself.
Yeah.
But it's just that kind of fundamental. I used to always think when I first arrived, Somerset was my first club, and I was 18 years old, playing with men, you know, and some very serious professionals, and they didn't care who I was or what I did. And I had a 1-year contract, so I had 1 year to prove that I could do okay. Mm-hmm. And in that time, I just went to a place in my mind going, I'm prepared to do something that other people aren't prepared to do. That's, you know, I'm prepared to train harder. I'm prepared to stick at this longer. I'm prepared to endure more pain in order to survive, because I want this more than other people want this. And, you know, that just stayed with me throughout my career. And I don't know where you access that, but to allow yourself to access it is very powerful. It's very... And I guess it's kind of the thing that I couldn't do, which led to me, you know, ultimately having a breakdown, was I couldn't turn it off. And I've only really learned since my breakdown is essentially how to access it and turn it off. Whereas in cricket, it was just like, revving the engine into red constantly, and just being that rage, just being like, I'm going to survive, I'm going to survive, I'm going to survive. And it just being relentless.
And when you were talking there, what was going on in my mind was, what are the implications of all of this? And you kind of got there in terms of this can't actually go on forever. So what happened for you and to you when the engine was so over revved that it broke?
So the way I've described it in the past is, it's a bit like trying to draw a straight line with your hand. And it's like doing it again and again and again. It's not straight enough. It's like doing that for 20 years. You know, it's not straight enough. And looking back, you can't, where does that go? That is just, you're just a pressure cooker, you know, a pressure cooker. And the same mechanisms within me that when I was under enormous pressure or under physical pain would go, I'm going to make this work. I need to pull something out of the bag here. I need to survive. I need to train to make myself, you know, until the point I'm sick. I need to, that the same bits that allow you to do that, they eventually, the pressure cooker blows. Mm-hmm. And you need release, you need out. Because, and I remember being asked in rehab if I was running away from anything. And I said, I think I'm running away from myself. Because I just couldn't, you can't have it both ways. I couldn't have that intensity and just turn on TV at 7 o'clock and just, you know, relax. I didn't know how to do the two of them. So looking back, I didn't know it at the time because I was just like, I'm going to make this work. But looking back, I was only ever going to blow up because I don't know how else you keep revving the engine into red and then expect you just to calm down. I don't think it's possible.
And was your, you know, your use of alcohol, was that the coping mechanism that you found to help with the engine, the metaphorical engine that we've been talking about?
100%. Yeah, it allowed me to get out of my head, you know, but then that intensity sort of came to my drinking as well, you know, and it was the same sort of thing. I do hear it in a lot of professional sports people now, and it's why these problems are quite common or commonish, but yeah, the intensity came with me, and so when I'd start drinking, that was it. I was really on it, and I'd go missing for days and things like that. But then I'd have the same intensity to go, right, I need to get myself back in shape, you know, back ready to play. So I'd have, you know, mornings where I would I'd be still be drunk, and I would train to sober myself up and then sort of take a load of painkillers and water in order to then go and play. And it was like, I was able to do it, which is a bit scary, really, because you think the damage you're doing to myself. So alcohol was kind of like, it served its purpose because it allowed me to get out of my head and relax for that period of time. But then it became all part of it, you know, this kind of work hard, play hard. And it was just all wrapped into this intensity that I didn't have any control on.
And so how, for context again, how long did that go on for, in terms of the, obviously your playing career was 20 years. How long was the use of alcohol in this way to get you just through, as I say, get out of my head and just get through the days?
I mean, looking back, it was there the whole time, but it just progressively got worse. You know, if you take it from when I was, like, I first signed, I was playing professional cricket 16, 17, then I officially signed 18. Alcohol was still around then. It was still not healthy in the way I was using it. And then you take that to, by, you know, the last 2 weeks before I went into rehab, I was basically drinking 24 hours a day. If I was awake, I was drinking. So from that 17, 18 year old to the 35 year old, 36 year old, it just progressively got worse during that time. There were certain things that sped it up, but it was just a progressive down. I always think of it as like an ever decreasing circle, you know, that essentially at the start you don't even know it's there. It's so wide and moving so slowly. But over the years, it speeds up and up and up, and then it gets really tight on you. And then in the last, you know, the last 2 years of my career, it was a real problem.
Yeah, like, yeah, as you were drawing that with your hand, it's like this vortex that's just sucking you down. And if you're okay to, when the sort of the moment of something's got to change, something's got to be different here, the move into rehab, how did that come about? And was that a you thing, or was that a group of people who said, come on, Luke, something's got to change here?
Yeah, I mean, I would love to say it was a me thing, but I wasn't there. I wasn't capable. I was really at a breakdown point where I was drinking nonstop, essentially, you know, by and large. I'd separated from my wife, and I was in an apartment, and it was towards the end of the 2011 season. It was the end of the season. And so, you know, it was like the end of the season. It was kind of blowing off steam anyway. A lot of players did that. But for me, this was sort of the beginning of the end. And what I didn't realise is that essentially my behaviour was causing some serious red flags for my friends and my teammates. And my behaviour around it was sort of alarming them more and more. And as I was going through this period of time, they were obviously talking to each other, saying, you know, we need to do something here. And then, you know, the final day of it, which, you know, and I have to say, like, when I say this, it doesn't fill me with any joy, or I still carry some real deep regret and shame around it. But on the final day, my twins needed to go to hospital, and I had been pretty much drinking all night, and but I remembered about them needing to go to hospital, and I went round to my ex-wife's house about 8:30 in the morning, and of course the kids couldn't smell me, or they were like, oh, it's daddy, 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 and, you know, jumping all over me. And I said to Jude, my ex-wife, well, when are we going to hospital? And she said, you're not coming. And I said, why? And she said, because you're drunk. And, you know, even now, after all this time, it makes me emotional now. And the thing was, you know, you'd think that moment was where you'd go, shit, this is bad. I didn't, you know, she left and I stayed in the house, and I went and took red wine from her wine rack and started drinking red wine. And And then I got up and I walked to the pub, and I walked till Wetherspoons opened at 10 o'clock, and I just sat in there drinking. And, you know, I look back on it now, it's desperate, it's desperate stuff, you know, really desperate stuff. A guy sort of desperately unhappy, trying to essentially drive himself to a really bad place. And I was sort of ringing people during that day, you know, like sort of cries for help. But then I was so tired. I was sort of a bit delirious. I was obviously very drunk, but I was like in and out of being not conscious, but, you know, being understandable or making any sense. And then about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, a couple of my old teammates just walked into the pub. And they came up and I went, oh, great, you know, maybe not in these words, but great, you're here. Like, why don't you come and join me? And they said, yeah, we'll come and join you. And I said, oh, do you want a beer? And they were like, no, you know, we'll be all right. We'll sit with you. And then they said, you know, do you want something to eat? And I said, no, I'm drinking. And they said, all right, well, we'll just sit with you and we'll have some food. And they ate some food, and obviously they were the first part of the party that was coming to get me, basically. Mm-hmm. And then one of them said, listen, why don't we go back to my house? And I said to him, can I carry on drinking? And he said, yeah, you can carry on drinking, that's no problem. So I went back to their house, and I was sat outside in the garden drinking, obviously. And my dad walked in. Mm-hmm. And you know, that was not a good moment, because, you know, why was it so bad? Because there was nowhere to hide. You know, that was where I was at, sat in a garden drunk, and I'd been drinking for, you know, felt like forever. Mm-hmm. Having an absolute, complete and utter breakdown. And my dad, you know, could see it, and I couldn't hide from it. And it was horrific. And anyway, he said to me, look, we're going to take you to rehab. And I said, no, absolutely no way. Kind of threatened to, you know, wrestle my way out of it or whatever. I said, they can't help me. You know, I don't want to go there. And my dad said, okay, why don't you just come back to the apartment? Your mum's there as well. And I said, can I carry on drinking? And he said, no. And I went back to the apartment, had a night in the apartment, and I was obviously detoxing in a quite heavy way. So it was a pretty brutal night, you know, sort of hallucinating and sweats. And I woke up the next day, and I've never felt so bad in so many ways. And I just said, please take me into rehab. And that's where I went in. So it wasn't me. It wasn't anything to do with me. And actually, even going in wasn't, what I look back on, it wasn't really a, okay, I need to get help here. It was just the kind of, I need to be protected from myself. The actual next bit of the realization that I wasn't very well and I really needed help wasn't there yet. It still took some time when I was in rehab. But it was... you know, for that intervention of my friends and family, I know I can never thank them enough for that. They saved my life, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah. And I mean, firstly, thank you for, you know, sharing that and your openness and the vulnerability to it. And I know you're feeling a lot of emotion, as am I actually, going with you sharing that. So the rehab experience, how was that? Because as a sportsman, I think we talked about this before, you know, it's all about results. Mm. And success was a result, a positive result. What do you remember? Did you have a mindset when you went in there in terms of how I want this to be? Or is it a case of just, I'm just existing?
I mean, I think I was a complete prick when I first went in, if I'm honest. I remember saying to I'm trying to remember the name of the guy, the sort of guy checks you in, essentially does all the like basic medical, you know, blood pressure and that kind of stuff. He's a Scottish guy. And I remember saying to him, you know, I better be, and as I described this, I know how much of a prick I sound. It was part of my illness. Yeah. But I was like, I need to feel better in 48 hours. You need to, otherwise I'm out of here. You've got 48 hours, otherwise I'm out. You know, I was essentially a park bench drunk, and I'm telling them that they've got 48 hours to make me better. You know, it's so embarrassing to look back on. And he was, I mean, he's heard it, the guy had heard it all before. He was like, in you come, son. And, but I just thought, I'm kind of in the wrong place. That's how I felt. Like, I felt I had such a huge ego and such low self-esteem. So, you know, on one hand, I thought I didn't have anything really left to live for. And on the other hand, I thought I was better than everybody else. And they explained to me, well, the initial program is a 28-day program. And I said, okay, I'll do 7. That's what, you know, it's just laughable. I said, and it was like, you know, why? And I said, well, because I think I'll probably do it faster than everyone else. And I just, you know, I am embarrassed as I'm saying this. But that's where I was at. It was like everything was my rules. You know, it was like I'll do this, but it's on my terms. You know, so I said I'll do 7 days, and everyone's like, oh, please, Luke, just, you know, imagine poor people around me were like, oh, for fuck, please, just, you know, do this. And I said, no, I'll do 7. And then I got to about day 6, and my mum kind of begged me to do a bit longer. And I said, all right, I'll do 14. I'll do another week. And actually, during that first week, I started to sleep a bit better. I was eating 3 meals a day, you know, and I was kind of enjoying the group therapy session. I was really identifying with people, even though I hadn't quite got to the point of looking inward. I was definitely connecting, going, wow, that is like me. And then on day 13, it was a Friday night, I went to a sort of little group therapy meeting, and a recovering addict called Janet, beautiful woman, spoke that night. And there was something about the way that she spoke. And she said, just, and I think she's used the phrase, love yourself better. And I don't know why. Maybe it was my moment. Maybe it was God or the universe kind of going, come on, now's your time. Yeah. And I just had this epiphany. And I was like, I'm the problem. It's me. You know, I have all these reasons why I'm behaving the way I'm behaving. But if I'm to get better, it's got to be me. And I came out of that meeting, and I just rang my parents. I said, I'm really unwell. I'm going to cry again. I'm really unwell, and I need to stay here. I need to stay here for the full time and maybe longer. And they, you know, they really supported me. And it was like I started listening. I started listening and realizing it was on me. You know, it was on me to get better. And honestly, that evening, day 13, was the beginning of me recovering to where I am today, because it was that first moment where I was like, this is on me. I've got to get better. It's no one else's responsibility.
And wow. And it was that word you just used at the end was the word that was coming around for me, was this taking of responsibility for yourself for what sounds like for the first time in a very long time. Wow. Let's take a beat. No, it's amazing. So rehab was, you know, after the sort of the initial push away, then you embraced it by the sound of it. And you, right at the beginning, you did talk about, you know, I asked you what people need to know about you, and you said it's really about rebuilding. What were the big steps that you started to take after that? Because I guess this is the end of your sports career, which, again, I can only imagine is an incredibly difficult transition anyway. And I know you help a lot of people doing that transition now yourself. What did you do to rebuild, Luke? And what were the commitments in that?
I mean, it felt a little bit like treading on eggshells. It was a little bit like walking through treacle. Sometimes it was just tiny steps of what I do next. And the best thing for rehab that came for me, and there was, you know, those therapists were, in my case, exceptional people, exceptional people, but they gave me a flight path. They gave me a kind of structure. All I had to do was take a leap of faith. That's what I had to go. I'll trust this. I don't know where this is going to go, but I'll trust what they're telling me. And they gave me a flight path. You know, they gave me, come do this, do this, do this. And I just kept stepping forward. But I, you know, I came out of rehab and essentially the car crash of my life was waiting for me. You know, I'd been cocooned away and suddenly it was like, oh, okay. I had still had 2 years left on my contract to go back to a club where, you know, could I sort of carry on in that environment where, and not drink, you know, I didn't, and they, you know, the club weren't that sympathetic, to be perfectly honest. You know, professional cricket or professional sport can be pretty brutal. Mm-hmm. And I was, you know, a higher paid player, I was 35, I was 36, I wasn't getting any better. So they weren't all that sympathetic, and actually it turned out to be a real, real saving grace. I don't think I could have stayed sober playing cricket. So I retired, I came out. I then had, you know, I'd put my ex-wife through, you know, awful times, and I now aim to be the best ex-husband I can possibly be. Mm. She's an amazing woman, but I, you know, I put her through some difficulties, and I had to face all of that. I had to stay sober. I had lots of people asking me questions, what was going on with me, journalists, you know, talk of, you know, we'll print something in a newspaper and all those sorts of that pressure around it. And I was just like, I've just got to keep stepping forward. One foot in front of that. I can't go back to what I was doing before because I'll die. Honestly, I'll die. I've got to just one foot in front. I've got to go to my meetings. I've got to do what the program's taught me to do. I've got to learn a different way. And I just go step by step by step. And that first year was just that, yeah, step by step.
Yeah, just so that's just that next thing that's in front of you. Just do that. And meetings, is that AA?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I've been to all sorts of meetings. Yeah, AA predominantly, but I've been to, you know, NA, CA, any meeting I'll go to, because really it's just, you know, a collection of people who, you know, coming with a shared problem of addiction. And, you know, I always knew with meetings, when I went in there, my first sponsor used to say to me, it's not like fucking X Factor. You're not grading the meeting. You know, and my ego would come back into play and I'd be like, oh, this isn't a very good meeting. And he'd be like, do you know what a meeting is? It's just sit down for an hour and a half and listen. That's it. And when you're so wrapped up in yourself, to sit down for an hour and a half and just listen is good work. And so meetings were that for me. It was reconnecting, it was grounding me, it was remembering, it was learning, it was hearing about people with more experience than me. And I needed it, really, really needed it at that time, because I needed to learn another way. And, yeah, and having people in front of me who were doing it was amazing.
Mm. I just get the sense of a lot of, as you said, with the therapists in rehab, a lot of trust in the steps of the program and your sponsor, and then in yourself, that yeah, I can do this. I can day by day live without what you've needed to live with for kind of for all this time.
Yeah, but I would say though that what I realized was my problem. I know this might sound a bit back to front to people, but my problem wasn't alcohol. My problem was life. I couldn't, you know, I had this method of life, which, like you said, it, you know, it was never going to be sustainable. But I thought it was who I was, you know, and I was quite unapologetic about it when I played cricket. It's like, take it or leave it. This is the way I operate. You know, I'd be a nightmare for girlfriends or, you know, my ex-wife. And because it was my way or the highway, there was no, and essentially that's what drove me nearly into the ground. So I had to, and they were amazing in rehab about this, and, you know, essentially pointing out that, you know, it wasn't about alcohol. My alcohol was my release. It was learning to deal with life, pressure, stress, responsibility, acceptance, faith. Faith is a huge one. So I talk about that leap of faith, but honestly, in my recovery now, faith is enormous. Faith, you know, that mojo of like, I don't know what's going to happen today, but I'm up for it. That's faith. That's faith. We're going to be okay, you know. And so it was just having to relearn stuff and get it wrong, you know, and get go, oh, shit, I've done that thing again, you know, and I'm not looking at my part in it. I'm looking at, I'm blaming someone else. And I, you know, that sort of, it's like constant working progress. It still is today, but it was just learning. And then alcohol just became, you know, a thing that I just didn't need anymore because I just found this better way of dealing with life.
I haven't really heard it put that way, honestly, before, that, you know, that alcohol's not the problem. It's you. It's you. Yeah, it's you and your view of yourself, view of you in life. That's the thing, and that's what you need to work on. And obviously you did, and you have, and you are. Mm. So I see this as an ongoing piece. And how has it changed you now? And let's sort of, we'll sort of move a little bit further up to date in terms of, I know. You work with athletes. You're a businessman. You're an author as well, and a successful podcaster as well. To boots, there's lots going on for you. How does this? I don't know if this is Luke 2.0. Maybe not a great way of putting it, but the new you that you're constantly building. How do you better deal with all, you know, life and everything that's coming at you and everything you're spinning?
It's a great question. You know, although I've changed enormously as a person, that intensity around achieving and doing stuff is still there. It's in my DNA. So, you know, if it comes to business or, you know, I want to write a book or whatever, I'll go and I'll do it. I'll commit to it. And that's from something within me that just wants to do and be active. And I think what I have to work really hard on today is being able to recognize when I'm revving in the red too much, where I had no vision of that at all. But now I can see when I'm going a bit too much, and then I have to pull myself back. And do you know what? Spending time in Ibiza is a big part of that. Yeah. It's a huge part of that. Space, nature, different way of thinking, different way of life. It allows me to breathe and actually ground myself again. But just being able to, so I think I'll always want to be busy. I'll always want to be doing stuff. And I love working. I love challenges. I want to be active. But I've got where I've got to look after myself is knowing when I'm pushing it too hard. And when those warning signs come on, just pull back.
Yeah. No, I love that. You have this very clear sense of your essential self, and you've separated it from, you know, what was going on before. And you go, that's good. That's good. That's who I am. And this self-awareness to know just where am I on that rev counter of life, and where am I pushing it, and what, I guess, who do I need around me? Where do I need to be? What do I need to be doing? Eating, kind of all of these things. And was on the Ibiza thing, was that a move here to create that space to get away from, I don't know, the noise perhaps of the UK?
Yeah, I think so. But I think it was more, you know, I was coming here spending time, and then obviously I met Jojo and then wanted to spend even more time here. But I think there's the kind of, every time I was back and forth, I realized that when I got here, I could breathe, and actually I was really productive, but I didn't feel that heaviness of, you know, and I don't know if I create it in my own mind. I could well do, but when I'm in England for too long, I can feel very heavy. It's like it's very dense on me, and I feel pressure, a lot of pressure and expectation. I'm like going, oh, that's that stuff coming back again. And actually when I come to Ibiza, as the plane is landing, I honestly feel like my chest goes and breathe. You know, I've you're nodding away, but I've mentioned it to other people, and they feel the same. It's like, oh, it's okay. We're going to be okay. And I think so, you know, like all things, there's a bit of a gradual nature to it. I was coming back and forth and feeling that more and more and going, do you know what? I can move back and forth from the UK to Ibiza. And, you know, I'm not here 100% of the time. I spend a lot of time in England as well, but it gives me that outlet, which I really need. And I guess then I just had to trust myself that, yeah, I could still be productive and make business work and things like that. But I just, without that health, without that freedom and health, yeah, health, I don't have anything. So if I'm not able to be happy and healthy, it doesn't matter how busy I am. You know, I'll go back. I have it within me to go back to where I got to. It's still there. Yeah, okay. I have to look after myself, and so part of that is this.
Yeah, and I get this from a lot of the things that you're doing. So there's the clear sense of looking after yourself, which is, I always use the put on your own oxygen mask first thing to help those around you better. But I do see you in support of lots of people, be it writing books about your experience, be it mentoring athletes, and very specifically the Understanding Men podcast that you and Fraser Franks have committed to and creating amazing content around. So is that something that's always been in you, as that I want to help, or is that a consequence perhaps of everything that you've been through?
It's a consequence. Yeah, it's a consequence. It's a beautiful consequence of recovery. You know, within a recovery program, mine's a 12-step program. The 12th step is helping others. It's carrying the message, and that's a fundamental part of where you get to the end. And for me, that's definitely been a huge part of my own recovery. And when I have that ability to get stuck in my head and get quite insular. And the way I can counteract that is by asking someone else how they are. It stops me thinking about me. You know, I don't mean in an avoidance way, but it stops me getting quite self-absorbed and considering, where other people are at. And I've just found from my own experience that the more I connect with other people to help them if I can, it's really good for me. It reminds me of, that journey, everything we're talking about. You know, this will be a really healthy chat for me, because it reminds me, it reminds me of that. And, life moves on, doesn't it? And you kind of, it's 13 years ago and you kind of forget it. But I can, going back to that pinpoint of pain, it's there. It reminds me of everything that's happened. And I think being connected and helping other people is hopefully I'm helping other people, but I am helping myself as well.
Yeah, and that as a man and from your background in as I say, in highly competitive professional sports, having that, I used the word before, but that vulnerability, the openness, this is what I went through. And if I talk about where I was and how I got stuck and lost, perhaps here's the invitation to a young man or a young woman, you might not have to go through that. That's the sense I get from some of the things you were doing.
Yeah, 100%. And when you're playing professional sport, that I'm sure there's other examples in life, but in this instance, it's alpha. It's no vulnerability. You can't show weakness. You can't show weakness to your teammates, let alone the opposition. You have to be that front. You have to front up always. And, I look back on my experience and as a man, what would I describe the most overarching feeling I had in the last 2 or 3 years of me kind of falling apart? Loneliness. I felt so lonely. I remember going into rehab and just crying like a baby, because I just felt on my own, desperately lonely. And I couldn't talk about, I didn't know where to talk about what I was feeling or doing. I knew I was unraveling. I didn't need to, I knew, but I just didn't know how to express that. And so I think my motivation nowadays is exactly that. If I show my vulnerability, I know that there are other professional sports people, athletes, or anyone in life who goes, particularly men, who goes, yeah, I get that, and that might just allow them to speak to somebody about it. Because I tell you, on the first day of rehab, I went into a group therapy session, and there it was a very male dominated group from all walks of life. And there was a guy opposite me who was high up in the drug trade in Liverpool, and little guy, and he and I couldn't have had more different backgrounds. you know, I was like Silver Spoon professional sportsman. He was on the streets, drug dealer, hard as nails. And I heard him speak on day one, and he talked about wanting to be a better man, wanting to be a better father, about how lonely he felt, about where he'd got to. He didn't have the answers, but he just wanted to find a better way. And in that moment, I was like, that's the first time I've heard someone speak what's going on in me. And I just wasn't yet at the place I knew how to do anything with it, but I heard him say it, and it was like, wow. And I wanted to go to the next session because I wanted to hear him again. And he and I was like, we're so different, but we're not different. So I think that's the power of, you know, sharing and showing vulnerability, is that someone, whether they tell you or not, might just go, yeah, I get that.
Yeah, you know, there's this sense of obviously a shared humanity, but also there's something about group as well. And this sense in group is, you know, I use this sometimes, I didn't know that about me until you said it about you, right? And that it seems what that did for you, yeah. in that moment. He was talking about himself, but he could have absolutely been talking about you and your experience.
Absolutely, he was two different walks of life, but he definitely was the same experience, same place, and that, like you said earlier, it's that permission, isn't it? It's that permission to let your guard down. Because, by the way, he also talked about having to front up. He was like, if I show weakness in my world, I die. So I can't show weakness. I have to front up. And I was like, okay, it's not life or death for me, but it's the same. Yeah. I won't survive, you know, in if I show weakness. Yeah. And, you know, in those walls of rehab where no one else is going to hear you, it's that first time where you can go, fuck, I'm really struggling. You know, I'm really struggling. And I just think, I know you and I have talked about it privately as well. I think men, we struggle with that sometimes, and it's just powerful to hear someone else, another man, sort of open the door for it.
We the whole no man is an island, but we seem to create islands of ourselves and hide in our cave, and all this sort of learned behavior that's kind of, you know, sort of passed down generationally. And I think the great thing about the work that you're doing is breaking those, almost the taboos. Because it's just being honest, being open, being vulnerable is incredibly healthy. I think more conversations like, you know, the one we're having right now, the ones that you have every week with Fraser on the podcast, and the ones we have individually, are just so, so important for men especially to go, you know, I can share how I'm feeling. Because, as you said, the flip of that is getting so, so isolated. Just touching on the sports realm now and the athletes that you work with, what advice are you imparting to sports people now? Because I'm curious around, because we have so much more awareness of mental health and the implications of that, you know, revving the engine so hard for so long. Is change afoot there? Can you be? I suppose my question is: can you still be a highly successful sports person and have that sense of self-awareness and know when to say, well, that's enough, enough's enough, I have to do something different? And it's a long question, but there's something you can unpick in there.
No, it's a good question. I don't think so. Honestly, you know, that's my straightest answer. I don't, you know, let's think about an Olympian. Olympian has, you know, especially if they've been in a sport they've needed to be in some from a young age, 4 or 5 years old, a gymnast or a swimmer or an athlete potentially, they will have been obsessed with that sport from a very young age, with the conditioning that at the end of it is the Olympics. This is the greatest sporting event that the world's ever had. Historically, it's enormous. The history, the tradition, the symbolism, everything. And they are absolutely obsessed by it. And everything gets out of the way. To be that good, everything has to get out of the way. And they work their way towards that goal. And the question is it realistic for us to ask that person to be well balanced? And in perspective, it's not possible. It's not possible at all. They have to be like that. And I think my job is not to try and change them. It's just to keep an eye on them and keep an eye on that. And actually, most importantly, what happens after the Olympics? And I've been fortunate to work with people who've won Olympic gold medals and people who've bombed in the Olympics. And actually, after an Olympic Games, it's pretty much the same. They all have an enormous crash because they've been working towards this particular thing their whole lives. What would we do if we were, you know, as a cricket player, just one game, you know, or a football, one, or one business deal, or one book, or one podcast? You know, you're going to fall after it. Yeah. And so for me, it's not necessarily changing them, because that's the world they have to survive in. You still have to survive in it. But would I have benefited from someone just saying, you know, keeping an eye on me? And as things started to rev up, just saying, listen, let's talk now, you know. But fundamentally, you still have to have that dog in you, that obsessive nature, in order to achieve those things. I just think you need good people around you now who will support you, essentially leaving that world and then going into the real world where, you know, you're not fighting for an Olympics or a sport, you know, next professional contract. You're back into a more normal lifestyle and being able to cope with it.
I love the honesty of that and the end of it. You know, to be successful in sport, you still need that, and having this a better support system around you, better people are going to look out for your well-being during and at that moment, and then importantly, obviously, after as well. Well, Luke, I mean, this has been an incredible conversation. Massively enjoyed it. I just wanted to also ask you, I was sort of checking at the end, and we've touched on this a little bit. Are there things that you're doing, almost your daily practices, that, you know, coming back to that mojo of 9.5 that we set out with, and you said it's generally pretty high, the things that, you know, this is where I need to be every day, doing these sorts of things.
Yes, and I live by it. Every day, I remind myself in the shower to show up. I need to show up today. I need to show up for Jojo. I need to show up for my kids. I need to show up for Jude, my ex-wife. I need to show up for my friends and family. I need to show up as a business owner. I need to show up. And that doesn't mean I'm going to smash it out of the park every day. It doesn't mean I'm not going to make mistakes. It means I might even say silly things that I later regret, or behave in a way I later regret. But showing up is, I'm here, I'm going to give my best. And that is an absolute non-negotiable for me on a daily basis. And then at the end of the day, I have to remind myself to accept the day. Accept it. It was okay, you know, whatever happens at the end of today, it was meant to be, and that's the way it is, and that's okay. I know if I go to bed and I'm wrestling around with something in my head, it's because I've not accepted it. I've not accepted, whether it was perfect or terrible, I've not accepted it. So I have to start the day going, listen, I show up today for everything that I need to do, and at the end of the day, it was what it was. That's great. We'll go to sleep tonight. We'll go again tomorrow. And if I'm revving the engine in the red too much, I just go and spend time with Jojo and the kids, and I cuddle them, and we go and do basic things and go to the beach and go to the supermarket, and the engine starts to rev back down again, and that's it.
Wow, beautiful, Luke. Thank you so much. I mean, an amazing conversation. Thank you for all the wisdom and, you know, really the benefit of your lived experience and what you've chosen to do is sharing that, you know, with me today and all the other the channels and the ways that you do it. And I thank you for that. So thank you so much for joining the Mojo podcast today, Luke.
Pleasure. Loved it. Thank you.
Yes, I told you it was a special episode. Massive thanks and kudos and respect to Luke for being just so open, honest, frank and forthcoming in our conversation. I think it's so important for men like Luke to be role models for other men, especially as we resist getting isolated, resist closing up, and to understand other people are going through what you are too, and how helpful that can be. Once again, please do share with anyone you feel would benefit from hearing this episode and Luke's story. The podcast will be back in 2 weeks' time. If you can't wait that long, there are nearly 80 amazing conversations in the back catalogue of the Mojo podcast, so go and enjoy those. Until next time, I hope your mojo continues to flow.